gentlemen, may I have your attention?
March 1st, 2021, the date of our first episode. The topic, COVID. Ever since then, we have covered a wide variety of topics from migration to Muni. Welcome to another episode of Latina, Latino, Latinx. My name is Monty Rossetti. On this episode, my El Tecolote colleagues, Alexis Terrazas and Eva Moshido, go back and revisit some of the conversations we had.
Eva, you've been interning with us at El Tecolote since the fall. How's that experience been for you?
Yeah, it's been great. I've gotten to meet a lot of cool people, do some really interesting interviews. And yeah, I feel like one thing that we've asked kind of at every interview has been, how are you doing? You know, how's this year affected you? And how have you been impacted personally and professionally by the pandemic? So I feel like that's been cool to see on Radio Teco too, how Each person that we talked to kind of talked about how the pandemic's not just been in their work, but it's been affecting their personal lives and like their mental health and everything.
Absolutely. That was a constant. And, you know, that was definitely like something that was really consistent throughout this first year of creating this podcast. Is it just felt quite natural. And honestly, like us launching this podcast in the middle of a pandemic, no less, not face to face, it just felt, like I said, natural just to, hey, before we get into the griminess of all of this, like, how are you?
Yep.
You know, just to be really human.
Yep.
And speaking of the pandemic, we're kicking this episode off with the first one we ever did. And so I'm curious as to what your thoughts were on our very first episode, You Don't Get It Till You Get It, which featured one of our colleagues, a journalist who actually got COVID, Alejandro Galicia Diaz.
Yeah, that was a super interesting episode because you're hearing from a young guy. He's 34, you know, he's a professional and he ended up in the hospital fighting for his life. So I think that was a really good reminder, as he said, that you don't realize it can happen to you until it does. And so I think right now with Omicron and the holidays coming up, you know, it's a good reminder to stay vigilant, especially seeing all the family and everything, and to remember that, you know, pandemic is still going on 2 years later.
Agreed. And I remember that really clearly, that episode or that interview, rather, because we did that episode in two parts. Mm. We interviewed Alejandro before the vaccine was made available and then after he had gotten his first shot. And we also talked a little bit about like the vaccine hesitancy that exists, not just in our like Latinx community, but in obviously a lot of other communities. Mm-hmm. So it's been really fascinating and probably lightweight frustrating too, to see still like 20 months into this thing.
Yep.
And with this new variant, and we get variants, I don't want to get into the whole thing because I'm not a scientist, but to see how, you know, there's still a lot of folks who still harbor hesitancies, you know, so that's been really interesting. So without further ado, have a listen to a snippet of this episode.
One of the things that I remember, like, as a kid, you know, going to my father's in 12-step recovery, right? And they would have, like, the serenity prayer, you know, kind of like a motto. Was there anything like that is circulated within your group, you know, like something that you could, like, latch on to keep that hope even when there seems to be none?
A lot of people on the group, including myself, we get frustrated with others who don't get us. And there's a saying, you don't get it until you get it. It means you don't understand what we're going through until you finally get it, you know, and not that we're wishing anyone to get sick, but we hold on to that, you know, and it's really true. You know, just the other week, you know, as Latinos, people of color, we you know, we see our numbers increasing, you know, people getting sick. And just 2 weeks ago, I was at Lucky's paying for my groceries, and you know, I'm covered. It's funny. I look like the Mandalorian. I have like the mask. Then I have a shield, and then I have goggles and everything. But there was a couple, a Latino couple, older couple, and you know how they can't get close to you until the cashier register, like, he calls them over. And but they didn't want to wait, I guess. And the lady puts her stuff, and I sort of extend my arm and like call to like, wait, hold up. She got offended. And then I assume she assumed that I couldn't understand Spanish. And she's just talking to her husband and talking all the smack, you know, like calling me a clown, all this and all that, cuss words. And the husband's like, oh, I wish he would do that to me. And I very calmly, because I wanted to go off, very calmly turn around, tell them, just a couple of months ago, I was in the hospital about to die. I had COVID, and the man was like, oh no, I'm sorry, son. I understand. And yeah, it's true. Like, they don't get, no one gets it until you get it. And a lot of people think, downplay the virus. You know, they don't care. They don't want to take the precautions. And that's frustrating for us. You know, I think we're traumatized. We don't want to get reinfected again. And that's why we're very cautious. And yeah, when people don't get it, it's just frustrating for us. But that's something that we say in the group.
All right, next up we hear from Gabriela Lopez, who's the president of the Board of Education, which is still a super relevant conversation, seeing as we're still going through that recall process right now. And we got to talk to her on her perspective on how it's been trying to reopen schools during the pandemic, you know, trying to work with all the compromises between parents and children and teachers, and then also just her experience as one of the youngest women elected to San Francisco office, and also as the first bilingual official in San Francisco. So yeah, that episode was really interesting to hear from me personally, because she opened up so honestly about not just the professional challenges, but also how it's really been impacting her, you know, all the trauma she's faced as a Latina in office and everything she's had to deal with.
Yeah, and everything that she still has to deal mm-hmm. with, obviously, right? We have this recall coming up, election for the Board of Education, you know, coming up this next year, early next year. So I feel like this would be, you know, it's interesting because when we do these episodes, we don't really think of like the longevity of it, right? We want to capture mm-hmm. the stories now. We mm-hmm. want to ask, like in this case, right? We ask Gabriela, you know, what are the top challenges for opening up, you know, amid a pandemic? Like, and at that time, you know, the vaccines weren't readily available. I don't even mm-hmm. remember if they certainly weren't approved for kids or students,
yeah.
right?
Yep.
You know, so we don't really kind of dive into these episodes really thinking about, oh, how's this episode going to age, you know?
Yeah.
But I feel like it's hyper, hyper timely even now with this recall coming up. But every one of these guests too kind of touched on, you know, this episode, right? Even the title of it, A Reminder to Be Human. I feel like that was captured in all of these episodes, you know? Like, yes, we're interviewing you and, you know, about what you're working on professionally, but every single one of them that we have here recapping really opened up, and we're vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
It allowed us to see them
yeah.
as human beings. And I feel like whether you're an angry, frustrated parent with having to raise kids in your house, like, I hope that this episode showed you a little bit of that. And so here's some words from Gabriela herself.
If you don't mind, and feel free, you know, if you don't feel comfortable, but what have been some of the biggest challenges for you, you know, as serving as board president and, you know, all the unique challenges this past year?
I was elected president in January of this year. And I think the biggest challenge is it's like more personal, because kind of like the reason why we're prevented from even running to be in this space is, again, all those insecurities that you feel. So once I was elected, within that month, it was basically every week where something pretty drastic for a board to hold was going on. And so at this point, it was the reaction to the renaming, which we inherited as a board, and we just needed to kind of like get through, which is why we even voted on it. It was the city's lawsuit, which sparked others to kind of consider this move of really forcing the reopening without partnering with the school districts that are doing all of this work. No one from the city ever reached out to me, at least, to kind of like walk through this and make a valiant effort before there was this sort of show and political show to get us to do it. There was, of course, the vote, the incident that happened at Lowell, which sparked the urgency to address what's going on at one of our high schools, and the work that we've been building on since October, and even decades before, that many groups have been organizing around. There was at the time the superintendent's message to retire. It just felt like one after the other, there were these big pieces. I can't even remember, but there are these tools that I had to tap into to kind of like help myself work through what we were all holding. And none of that was working anymore. I wasn't like writing. I wasn't leaving my home. Like, so the challenges are like, how do you hold really wanting to be in this space because you're here to work, but handling all of the distractions that really make it difficult for you to do it? And when you pair that with literally death threats and rape threats and people coming to your home, it's the reason why we can't be in this space. And I think it just worries me for future leaders. So working through that it's what's been my focus for the last month. I did take a moment where I just like completely gave up and was like, no, we're not gonna worry about like my own personal development to get through it, because there's so much to do. And I was just like fine with that. But now it's, I think, a little bit easier to breathe. And you just got to keep going. The one thing that people tell me over and over, I've heard this over and over, is this is a sign of like positive change and movement that's really affecting people in a way that we've been waiting for. But the abuse is something that I just can't understand. And I think I'm a lot better about ignoring things, but it's just heavy.
And next we hear from a gentleman, James Cordero, who is the co-director of the Water Drop program at Border Angels, which is a group that actually works alongside or works at the southern border, doing food and water drop-offs. And this one, Eva, for me is a bit personal too, right? Like my mom crossed this border, you know, back when she migrated here, and even the news today, right? We're recording this recap on December 3rd, and one of the headlines right now is how both the Biden and AMLO presidencies, Biden being the president here of the United States, AMLO being the president of Mexico, are reinstating the Trump-era Remain in Mexico policy. And while that is not exactly the same as, like, you know, the issue of, like, people crossing the border, it all kind of boils back down to, in my opinion, the continuing criminalization of migration and the further, like, militarization of the U.S.-Mexico border. And so, like, to hear some of what James was talking about in this episode, right, like, that this is a bipartisan effort, you know, because we spent 4 years demonizing Trump, I felt like this was this episode, and even given the news today, was really timely. But yeah, what were your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I thought it was super interesting how he's talking about that these are strategic decisions put in place by the U.S. government to affect how people cross the border. You know, they're not accidents, and they happen, Democrat, Republican, in all the different presidencies. Those things kind of ebb and flow, but this criminalization and the way it affects all these migrants is still going on, and it's still hugely an issue for all the people who are trying to cross the border to get to better lives. And I like his point at the end here that we'll hear in a minute, that people don't do this if they don't have to.
And, you know, we're recording this episode on June 9th. On June 7th, I did want to ask you this, you know, about the recent statements by Kamala Harris, Vice President Kamala Harris. When you hear like a politician like her, what is like, do not come, telling migrants specifically from Central America not to make this dangerous journey to this country? You know, as somebody who's familiar with the terrain, you know, knows that it is strategically placed, you know, for deterring migration here. What are your response, or what is your response when you hear, you know, words like that from somebody who, you know, representing a party that's supposed to be different from the previous administration?
No one risks their lives at, you know, in these conditions and this terrain and the environment where they're at. No one risks their lives for fun. I mean, people are doing this because they have to. They're displaced from, you know, climate change, from, you know, the economic situation, from imperialism. You know, people do this because they have to. It's not because they want to. This is reserved, you know, crossing through the desert is reserved for the most, lack of a better word, hard up people. If you have a ton of money and you want to get into the United States, it's a lot easier. It also varies on the color of your skin. You know, you never hear of, you know, a lot of European countries having issues with people and, you know, immigrants. But, you know, it further sells the demonization of, you know, Southern countries. I don't know if anything's going to change. In the last, we'll just say the last like almost 27 years since the National Policy of Prevention Through Deterrence was enacted, you can see that, you know, there has been no change depending on, you know, what political party has the office of the president, nor in Congress. Everybody, you know, acts together, and, you know, it's you see on the news that it's, you know, one side versus the other, but it's more so the people, the citizens versus, you know, the elites. And I feel that this situation, like I said, is reserved for those that don't have the resources and the means to get here other ways. And it is made, you know, very difficult. But, you know, in the end, if people make it through, then to the rich and powerful, you know, the powers that be, those are the most, you know, perfect model exploitable person that, you know, they can make their money off of. If they've made this hard journey and still survived, I mean, how could that not be, you know, a perfect person if you're these, you know, corporations or government officials or whoever is in charge, that they can make the most off of them? And it's, you know, kind of one of those survival of the fittest type situations that, you know, people do pass away all the time, and to those powers that be, they just probably look at them like, well, they weren't strong enough to be here anyway. I couldn't get anything out of them. I couldn't squeeze anything out of them. This is how quick they went, you know. So it's definitely one of those situations that's really messed up, and a lot of people probably don't think about it that way, but there is, you know, like a pyramid of, you know, in the end, money. It's all about, you know, the color green. And, you know, this country has always, you know, ran off the backs of others. So, I mean, it still continues this day, just in a different form.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, on the podcast and at El Tecolote, we've been trying to cover all the issues for our Latinx community down at the border and also right here in San Francisco. So for this one, we're going hyper-local. We're talking to Jeffrey Tumlin, the director of SFMTA, and he's telling us about all the challenges with funding Muni, especially right now during the pandemic when rides are low, and reopening the different lines, all the stages of that and what that means, which lines do we prioritize, which networks. And so I was impressed just with his thoughtfulness and strategy in reopening and making sure that there's a plan for equity and all the essential workers, the people who need to be taking the bus every day into work, that they're getting priority for which lines reopen and how they can commute to work.
One thing that stood out for me, or it reminded me of something, like you can't fake passion. Mm-hmm. And Jeffrey has a true passion for public transit. And that was really cool. I found him to be incredibly honest, and not just passionate, but honest in you know, like reveal or like acknowledging the certain challenges of operating Muni during a pandemic. Obviously, this pandemic kind of ripped the veil off of a lot of the issues that impact our society, even public transit, like who relies on it the most. You know, so for him to be as honest and forthcoming, I found it to be incredibly refreshing. Mm-hmm. And again, human, like humanizing. And I thought that was really neat. You know, and again, prioritizing, like, you know, we all saw that the folks who were using Muni during the pandemic were essential workers, were, you know, a lot of times like really blue collar folks that had no other choice to mm-hmm. do but to take public transit. And these were the same folks that were keeping our city going, you know. So yep. I found Jeffrey's, you know, honesty in answering like every single one of these questions. And of course, people always have something to complain about when it comes to public transit. So I just really appreciated his time and passion on the subject.
Yep. And it makes you think twice before you start complaining about the Muni too, which I appreciated. But I think he's one of those people who use the pandemic as an opportunity to create some positive change and to find creative solutions. So I appreciated that from him.
I'm sure you had a vision of what you were going to do when you came into the position, and then everything got turned on its head when the pandemic, you know, unfolded and the shutdown happened. How did that, you know, and the state that it was already in, I'm sure that there were already challenges in place. How did this change your vision? Do you feel like you've been able to find a way to still maintain some of the ideas that you had about the future for Muni? Because obviously you were thinking about, in the conversation we're having right now, I can tell that you're thinking about how to evolve with what the needs are now versus what we've been using since, I don't know, what was it, in the 1900s when they started the train system. So, yeah.
Well, so back in the middle of 2019, I was pretty certain that I did not want this job. It is arguably the second most thankless job in my entire industry, second only to the New York MTA job reporting to Governor Cuomo. And then I went on a 10-day Buddhist meditation retreat. And somehow or another in that retreat, I realized, you know, I was at the point in my career where I had nothing to lose. And I realized that it was time to commit myself to service. And that is why I ended up taking this job in December of 2019, which turned out to be a remarkably good motivation for surviving March of 2020 when the lockdown occurred. So I realized, okay, everything is upended. My agency is experiencing the worst health crisis than it has in 100 years, the worst financial crisis by far than it had in its entire history, and a racial justice reckoning from work uncompleted about 50 years ago. So, you know, okay, this is the most important possible time to simply serve. And I'm fortunate. My husband takes very good care of me. We do not have kids. I can work 80 and 90 hour weeks every week, although apparently not for, you know, 18 straight months. And use this series of compounded crises in order to do the best that we possibly can, but, you know, for the communities that we serve, and to not, as has happened so often in Muni's past history, to paper over our problems, but rather to confront them directly.
And for our last episode recap, we're kind of taking it back somewhat to the beginning. We're highlighting our episode, which featured Jackie Fielder, who was also somebody who we had featured on our Making of a Candidate podcast, the one that aired before, Radioteco. And Jackie, we had her on to discuss a bunch of different things, including her own Daybreak pack here in San Francisco, her political origin story, but more importantly, like, we were discussing the then recent news of Governor Gavin Newsom defeating the recall effort. But more importantly, you know, going forward into 2022, you know, what in her mind did he have to do to regain the trust of California voters? And, you know, this episode, it was really neat having Jackie on because she's a really interesting individual. And because sometimes we view politicians as, like, you know, just politicians, but mm-hmm. we forget that they are human. And she was also really honest about her own campaign that she was running in. Right. But Eva, I'm curious what your thoughts were listening to this one.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved her emphasis, kind of like James said, you know, we can't just buy into whatever party's in office. We have to make sure that they're actually working for the change we need to see. So I liked how she kind of gave a few action points of what Newsom would need to do in order to get, you know, get the people's vote again in the next year. And I also like how she unpacks some different hot button ideas that we've been discussing. You know, what is affordable housing? What does that actually mean? And who is it for? You know, obviously, like, how does it work on all different income levels? Does it just need to be affordable, or does it also need to be safe and beautiful and clean? And so I like how she really went into that and even brought it back to our whole ideas of, you know, like, how do we construct this idea of housing? Who is it a right for? Where did we get that concept of property rights and of housing rights and tenants' rights? So all very relevant conversations here in the Mission.
Yeah, and San Francisco, yep. Probably in general. Yep. And my last note on this was too, how she acknowledged, right, like, seeking therapy after mm-hmm. after her campaign, which I thought was incredibly brave. You yeah. know, we're in an era right now where, you know, seeking mental health services are less stigmatized, but nonetheless, like, to be able to actually go out and recognize and do that, I think speaks really highly of who Jackie is.
Mm-hmm. The word affordable housing, the phrase affordable housing, how affordable are we talking about? Because it is thrown around, and sometimes a building is, I know Matt Haney had a bill that, or an idea that was, like, shot down for a building in his district that was a certain amount was going to be affordable housing. How does that work? Why can't a whole building be affordable housing, especially when we're in a situation where we need affordable housing? Again, these are all probably silly questions, but since you are the expert, I wanted to ask you and see what you had to say about that.
Yeah. You know, I think it comes down to this pretty crazy idea that only came about during settler colonization, that you need to pay for housing. That's what we call the commodification of housing. Mm-hmm. And in our economic system, we put building housing in the hands of private developers, which means that you're only allocated housing to the extent that you have, you know, enough money to afford it. So what we really need is to completely reorient our view around housing as a human right. And to me, that's always meant putting our money where our mouth is. That means investing in quality social housing. Doesn't necessarily mean public-private partnerships where we're subsidizing private developers, and those developers are simply maximizing their profits. It doesn't mean that. It means taking profit out of the equation. It means what we call social housing, actually what it does is it doesn't exclude the middle income earners. It actually integrates folks of all different kinds of socioeconomic classes. Of course, we're not talking about like the San Francisco wealthy elite. Mm-hmm. But it does have a principle around ensuring that housing is beautiful, decent, green, enjoyable, safe, clean, and affordable, mm-hmm. for really anyone. And that it's not a marker really of social class. And there are examples around the world for that. But unfortunately, we find ourselves in an economic system that really just puts private developers in charge of that. And what we get is a kind of like bifurcated, really stratified system of housing where the people at the bottom are paying way too much for, I mean, everyone's paying a lot, but relatively, people at the bottom are paying way too much for housing. And we have a glut of housing at the top of the stratosphere. We have a glut of luxury housing. We have plenty of vacant units. And I always want to remind people lately that, for example, the Salesforce Tower, and all of its, 61 stories, there's only 100 people in that building as of last month. That's what the SF Examiner reported. And it's crazy. We have so much room for office space, so many tax subsidies for office space. We have so much, you know, we even hook them up to Hetch Hetchy to have power for their gigantic building. But we don't do that for basic mm-hmm. human needs. It's really a misplacement of priorities, I think.
Yeah, I loved getting to hear from each of these different perspectives. And I think we got to see all the good work they're doing in all their different corners, you know, at the border in San Francisco. And the work continues. There's obviously been a lot of challenges by the pandemic and just the inequities and problems we faced before that. But I think they're hopeful examples, which I appreciate. And also, I think they show us that if there's one thing we can take from 2021 into 2022, it's to have more space to be vulnerable and to be honest about these challenges and how they're affecting us personally and in our mental health and our daily lives.
Agreed. And, you know, I think in really trying moments such as 2021 and even mm-hmm. 2020,
yep.
it's difficult to recognize like any silver lining. But when we slow down and even here, like in this like microcosm of doing this recap, you know, we see like all these different stories of perseverance, you mm-hmm. know, and the momentum, you know, we've built as a collectively as a community to propel us forward. So I think, you know, the trick, I guess, for 2022 is to definitely rest, but to how to keep that momentum going.
Mm-hmm.
Because I definitely feel as, and we're not completely out of the woods of that are these trying times. But I do feel some seeds were planted to like really see a better future. And I'm always just like as a journalist, as an editor, as a dad, you know, when I see folks in our communities, you know, find the resilience and strength to do that, it fills me with hope. And, you know, it helps, you know, fuel my fire to continue telling these stories, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, I feel like if there's one thing I've gotten out of the months that I've been working here at El Tecolote too, it's to try to find those stories in those corners of people who are doing the work and who are persevering and trying to go against the grain and do something different and find better ways to do things. And I think that is hopeful. And I think that will give us that momentum that we need in 2022 is finding those perspectives and those people.
Awesome. Well said, Eva. Thank you so much for recapping this episode with us. And to all our listeners, look forward to this next season of Latina, Latino, Latinx coming to you in 2022.
Thank you, Eva. Thank you, Alexis, for that amazing recap of just a few of our great episodes of 2021. and we're looking forward to having more amazing episodes in 2022. I also wanted to say thank you to all of the people that have contributed and just been a part of our episodes for this year. Also, thank you to all of our guests who have taken time out of their busy schedules to sit down with us and have conversations with us. And our promise here at Radio Teco is to continue having great conversations and sharing more stories with people that need to be talked about more often, conversations and topics that need to be talked about more often. We hope to continue this promise for you in 2022. And please also check out our culture podcast named Our Cultura Podcast. You can find that anywhere you get your podcast as well. For everybody at El Tecolote, my name is Monty Rossetti. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you for listening to Radio Teco, the podcast of El Tecolote, California's longest running bilingual community Latino newspaper. If you enjoyed listening to this episode and are looking for more of our content, please visit our website, eltecolote.org. And if you value bilingual storytelling and would like to support our next 50 years of community journalism, please consider making a donation or sign up to volunteer.